Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt from Rolling Stone, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me Andy Green from Rolling Stone.
Well, hi there, Brian. How you doing?
I am pretty good. So we're going to do a couple things today. We're going to play some audio from my recent interview with Alicia Keys to start, and then we're going to talk about some current music-related events. But, you know, Alicia Keys has an album. Have you listened to this album yet here?
No.
You should listen to this album, Andy Green. It is actually really good, and it's probably one of her strongest albums in a long time. Alicia Keys' new album is called Here, and it's kind of a rootsy, risky, politically charged album, and I had a nice conversation with her about it. One of the things that struck me about the album and that she talked about is how it's very tied together with sort of skits and thematic links, and it all kind of functions as a piece. And I started out by asking her what albums inspired that particular approach. So here's what she had to say.
I mean, I would say albums like, you know, to me, the way Wu-Tang did their album was a big inspiration. You know, there was like those very thematic kind of things that just played through the records, and that was just consistent almost like with their whole career. And I would even say it's different, but I would say Illmatic, Nas's Illmatic, just because there was such a quality of a unified thought. When you listen to Illmatic, like, it's so specifically a moment in time.
For sure, it's almost like one long song or something.
You know?
Yeah,
it just all it belongs together. It's meant to be together. So I would say that. I would say What's Going On. Also, you know, in the way that was just always just this epic adventure that you just sonically got to really go places you just didn't know where you were headed. I love that so much. So that I would say those three.
And then, you know, since you do feel that this is such a breakthrough for you, and it does sound like that to me based on what I heard, I mean, what was the kind of key to unlock the place where you could get to this breakthrough, you know what I mean, where you could get to this new place?
Oh my gosh, I feel like the key to unlock is so many things. Like time, you know, just time and wisdom and learning and becoming clearer about myself, who I am, who I want to be, you know, what I feel, what I refuse, what I love, what I like dispute, what I despise, all of that, just becoming much more familiar with the inner workings of myself, I think. Which has also led me to become much more familiar and clearly understand the workings of the world, like who we are in the world, which has like also been really interesting thing, because that's the thing. I mean, we're all experiencing a different piece of the whole spectrum, I guess, in a way, or a different perspective of the whole spectrum. And some of us have similar perspectives, and some of us have totally different experiences. And so I think that's, you know, that's the reason why I called the album Here, is because that's just was such a layered word to me. It's like where I am here. Where we are here. Like where you are here. Like we are all here. That's where we all are. And we're kind of like meeting wherever we are here in this place that we are right now, and the ability to be able to actually look at myself in the mirror and just say like, wow, there you are. You're right here. And no judgment, no nothing. It's just like, it is what it is. That's where you are. And then be able to look at the world and look, be able to look at, you know, my friends, look at my family and be able to just kind of, talk about that and make that kind of a conversation and a dialogue and a something we can communicate about, because we might not all see it the same, but we all are feeling it in some capacity. So it's pretty ill. It's pretty ill. So that I think all of that kind of has led to this unleashing, this uncovering, this more vulnerable place, the willingness, the strength to be vulnerable. Like, and I think that also just comes with maturity too, you know, that just comes with some time to like realize the truth about stuff. So that you, at least my truth, you know, my truth. I got to start there.
Yeah, for sure. Holy War, when listening to that, it's a great song. And it was, you know, you debuted it in such a cool way, just rocking it a cappella to be amazing. It's incredible. But
thank you.
When I hear, you know, singing about walls and building walls and breaking walls, I mean, how much were you consciously thinking of Trump? And it, you know, coming up against that idea of building a, like, forget building the wall, let's break down the walls. How much was that a conscious kind of thing in that context?
I mean, it's all just what we're feeling. You know, it's all just what we're experiencing. So we're all living in this place, and we're all hearing this rhetoric, and we're all, like, feeling what that means literally, what that means metaphorically. You know, what we're experiencing by just being alive and living in so many different ways. Like, there's obvious walls, you know, that are in front of us, around us, wanting to be built.
Yeah.
And so I think that it just, you can't help it but feel it. And it's like this conscious choice in a way that, are we going to choose to keep doing that? Is that what we're going to choose to keep doing? Because I don't see it working. It's not working. Or are we going to try this whole other thing? And I think that I love that song so much, because I actually wrote it with this guy named Billy Walsh and Elangelo, who I did also in common with. But I wrote this song, and Billy Walsh is a poet. And at the beginning of the record, we kind of threw out a bunch of different thoughts and things that we knew I wanted to talk about, and that was important to me, and just what's happening around us. And one of the things that came up, though, out of nowhere was, like, what if I wrote with a poet? And I thought that was just the illest idea, because it would just kind of, like, allow the way that I process lyrics and process words to be then complemented by another person who likely processes them in a whole other different state and way. And so this just happened. I didn't seek out Billy. You know, he found me. And I believe that those things happen once you say them, like you're calling to them anyway. So I know I put it in the air for sure. But when it did happen, and when we wrote Holy War, it was just so ill. And the conversation, which, by the way, the album, the conversations around this album, which we were fortunate to be able to catch some of them, which are just so sick. It's so incredible to hear different people talk about their experience. It's like the most fascinating thing that maybe can happen, you know, and if you can actually shut up long enough to listen, which is most of our problems, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We don't. There's so much to take in, and you really start to learn so much about people. And so this particular conversation that we were having, which circled around this idea of, like, you know, if war is holy and sex is obscene, and we got it twisted, and it's just so crazy how we try to hide so many beautiful things or sensualities that we experience, or we look at, you know, we get so afraid to talk to our kids about sex, or, you know, we want to hide all of our body parts and cover them up and don't let anybody see the beauty of, like, you know, these such beautiful things like love and love making and things like that. But yet we're please give 100 kids 100 video games of, you know, 100 Call of Duties, and it's all good.
Yeah.
You can play Call of Duty all day and all night, and that's, like, no problem, you know? It's, like, very confusing and twisted and interesting. And so that, you know, so anyway, that kind of dialogue is what spawned on this whole song and this idea of these walls, which definitely need to be broken down.
Or not built, I guess.
Yeah, not built at all.
Yeah.
But because they do exist, and we have to acknowledge that they exist, I think, to break it, you know?
Yep.
I think that's another problem a little bit, is, like, we do such a ridiculous job. I don't know how this, where or how. I guess this is just from the beginning of time. But we do such a ridiculous job of pretending like things never happened. Or are not happening.
Yeah.
We're, like, living in a perpetual state of denial. It's weird.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's, like, we have to acknowledge that they're there so we can break them down.
Blended Family, I mean, it's got to be one of the most personal songs you've ever written, you know, and it, I thought it was very moving, and it it also digs into, you know, sensitive stuff in your life. What was the motivation of putting that out into the world?
Yeah, man. I mean, Blended Family is such an incredible, again, just sitting down and talking to people and listening to their stories and sharing my own story as well. It's so powerful. It's crazy powerful because the world is such an incredibly diverse place. And I think that's one thing that's so incredible to witness and see is just what the modern day family looks like.
Yeah.
And the modern day family is so, it's so varied and it's so rich and it's so complex and beautiful and interesting and to be able to kind of acknowledge the fact that there's so many, a family doesn't have to be any specific way. It can be so many different ways and it's been really cool because when you see the visual for Blended Family, I think you're gonna go nuts. It's crazy, but talking to kids and asking as a kid what a family is, and I asked some kids what a family is, and they were like, a family is people that love each other and stick together no matter what.
Mm.
And I was like, yo, they're so on it. This is like a 5-year-old. You know what I mean?
Right.
A 5-year-old. And so, you know, with my family and with my beautiful blended family, it's been such an honor and a privilege to be able to be an example of the fact that, you know, people who love each other and love the children that we're all able to raise together, you know, that we're able to absolutely choose to uplift each other. You know what I mean? And we're able to choose that we want this to be a positive experience for us. You know what I mean? And we are blessed that we have so many incredible experiences to teach our kids and teach them together. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or beautiful families that I know that are like, you know, two moms.
Sure.
Or two dads. You know what I mean? It's like it's all these gorgeous families that you know raise incredible children, and what our children are going to be is our children are going to be tolerant. You know, our children are going to be more open-minded. They're going to be more aware of the fact that there is no specified way that things go. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that love leads everything.
Right.
If you lead with love, you won. You won.
I hope so. I'm sure that's true.
It is.
Kill Your Mama is awesome. It reminds me, it's like a cross between like What's Going On and maybe like Lauryn Hill Unplugged or something. I just loved it. Trying to play God fucking with genetics. What were we talking about there?
Come on, everything.
Yeah.
You're a good listener. I like that. I mean, but that's what we're doing. I mean, we're like up in there re-engineering all types of things. And look, science is amazing. I feel like science is like rock stars. I've recently, you know, come into contact with a few different scientists that I've met, and they're like the things that they're working on and the things that they can even think of to begin to break down to then create, you know, is unreal to me. When I learn things like that, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the most intelligent, smart people I've ever met. And then money gets in the way, and then all of a sudden, something that was so brilliant gets destroyed by greed and can become very dangerous, you know? But like, the point is that I think that Kill Your Mama is really most importantly about
Mother Earth, I guess. Right? No?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about how we treat and respect and care about Mother Earth. And when I wrote it with Emily Sandy, and she was like, so she's such an amazing writer and artist. so dope. And when we came in that day, she was like, you know what, I've really been wanting to write kind of almost like, you know, something that is based almost on a lot of these kind of native, beautiful, beautiful songs, you know, that really do talk more about, you know, the times when we worshiped the trees and the sun and the wind and, you know, the ground and, like, you know, there was like a real true respect of the balance that has to be created in the earth, in the world for it to thrive. And so we kind of started there, and we started like kind of making these metaphors and then also just unleashing the way that we're feeling, which has a lot of kind of angst and urgency to it. So we smushed all that together. And I feel like that's what I love the most about that song. It's almost like blues, folk, like something. I don't know what it is, but it just, it feels, I love the way that all of those styles are colliding on that song.
I mean, overall, it seems like it's probably the most political album you've ever made. And I know that going back to, like, 2001, your first Rolling Stone cover story, you're talking about reading, you know, books about the Black Panthers and stuff. So you've been on this stuff since the beginning, but you maybe weren't always comfortable expressing it in song. So what changed there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I just, you know, you're right. You're totally right. And I've always been a bit of a, you know, I've always been very outspoken, and I've always felt really strongly about kind of things that were going on around us socially and politically, and I've always been very inspired by those artists who did that, you know, and those Curtis Mayfields and Nina Simone and Marvin Gaye's and those people who really, really just, you know, and Bob Dylan and John Lennon and just the Bob Marley's, the people who just totally took on somehow in this most beautifully human way, just the Stevie Wonder, you know, the Donny Hathaway, the things that are going on around us, you know, in a way that I feel like, you know, I don't know if it's, I guess, you know, that's just always been really incredible to me, and it's been very inspiring to me. And I didn't quite know how to do that in the beginning. It's not as hard as I realize now, but I just, in the beginning, I didn't understand how to put that into words exactly. Or I just didn't have the access maybe to the emotion, or, you know, access to the confidence or the strength or the clarity or the ballsiness or whatever it takes to just, like, be the clarity maybe.
Yeah.
All of those things combined. War is
holy. We'll be back in a couple minutes with more from Alicia Keys. We've got it twisted. In this lucid dream. We're going to play some more from my conversation with Alicia Keys. It is, believe it or not, the 15th anniversary of her debut, Songs in A Minor. And I asked her what she hears when she listens to that album now, 15 years later. Here's what she had to say.
I just have like such nostalgia and such good feelings. Actually, I remember a really specific time in my life, and I remember a very specific mentality, and it's just like everything pure, and everything before I really understood anything. I mean, I understood anything in the music business or stuff like that. You know what I mean? I understood things about life and living, but I really just remember this girl who's a lot like the woman I am now, you know, which is also really cool to me. And I recognize myself. It's not like I don't know who that person is. I totally know that person, and I know the heart that young girl has, and because I still have that same heart, full of love and like full of compassion and full of just yearning to find myself and my way and, you know, me. So I recognize that. I recognize all the parts that are rough around the edges and all the parts that are like not, you know, not well oiled. And I love that. I love that. And in fact, in a lot of ways, this album now, I feel like I've actually come back.
Yeah, I can see that.
That place. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I actually am really, really proud of that, because I think that there was so much of the best of me in that place, just because it was almost before. You know, it's almost, the only way I can think of describing it is almost before you get into your head.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like exactly who you are and how you are, and you really don't care to please anybody about it. You're just like, this is me.
Yeah.
And then somewhere along the way, you kind of get into your head about it.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm out of my head again and back in my heart.
What advice would you give the young Alicia Keys now, if you could? Not that you're not young anymore, by the way, but younger.
No, yeah, I'm super young because I started really young.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But what would I give? Yeah, what advice would I give my younger self? You know, I mean, I teeter totter on that because, in a way, like, man, what a freaking awesome person I am now, and I know that is because of all the things that I experienced and all the different parts of it all, you know? So I kind of feel like I wouldn't want to have done anything different because it's led me to such a good place. But I think if I was to give myself, my younger self, some advice, I think I would have encouraged myself to really learn how to hear my own voice a bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, you know, there's no time limit on anything. We're learning stuff every day. So, you know, there's no such thing as like you learned it late or you did something late or whatever. But it does feel like it took me kind of a while to really finally get back to hearing clearly, you know, myself, my inner voice, my truth. And maybe that's just because I just finally have ever heard it now. You know,
yeah.
I'm not sure if I heard it before to some degree, just by the nature of how things go, and then got away from it, or if I'm only ever hearing it right now at this point. But I would have encouraged myself to kind of do some work in that area and like be willing to sit kind of quietly with yourself to listen to the truth in yourself, and not spend so much time kind of convincing yourself what you think is the right thing to do, or spend so much time asking everyone else what you think is the right thing to do, and really learning how to discern, you know, what is right because it's right for you. And I think that just takes kind of quiet and space, and, you know, I think we get really used to asking people their opinion. We get really used to hearing people's opinions, actually,
yes.
Too, especially now, especially in this, like, ridiculously digital social world, you know
right.
What I mean? So I think that gets really distracting, and so I probably would have told myself that to the younger Alicia, and I would have also told my younger self just to, like, I think I also would have told myself to, like, I don't know if it's that I needed to write things down more,
mm-hmm.
or something, but I would have really. There's a lot of things I don't feel like I remember all the way in the sense of different moments that like I would have liked to write down the first moment I met Prince. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like write that down, because I guess in that moment you feel like you'll never forget it. You're like, how could I ever forget this? Like no way. And then there's, like, the nuances of it that you do kind of forget. And I would have liked to, like, be able to go back and be like, man, it's the first time I met Prince right here. So, stuff like that, I think. Simple stuff like that.
Speaking of people's opinions, do you think that the no-makeup thing has possibly gotten too much attention? As much of despite how positive it's been for you, is it possible that people are overly focused on it?
It's definitely intriguing to witness how much certain things, what things do get attention.
Yeah.
That's pretty intriguing and interesting. And I think that it's so interesting that something like you know, I said this the other day, like something like the press would be more interested in the fact that I'm not wearing makeup than the fact that 65 million girls don't have access to education.
Right.
It's like that would be that's a bigger story than the stories that are actually really important. You know what I mean? And so, not, you know, all things are important to some degree, but that would really benefit with having that level of attention on it. But I do think that what's interesting about the whole thing really is just this insane kind of obsession and standard that women are held to be perfect. You know what I mean? And I think that it's really, it's pretty intense. And I think it creates a really insecure kind of world. And, you know, I can speak for myself that I've felt that way many times. You know what I mean? And so I think that that's kind of what's so interesting about it all. But I think that the most important thing about everything is that, you know, I think that women are so incredible. Like, we're so freaking magnificent, like, all-encompassing, powerful beings. And I just think that it's so beautiful that we can express ourselves in any way we want, and that we should absolutely do whatever feels good for our body, our faces, our life.
Yeah.
Whatever feels empowering as a woman is what a woman should do. And that's the most important message that, you know, I want to speak on, and that I want to. I don't want to depend on anyone else's definition of beauty.
That was me talking with Alicia Keys, and we'll be back with more. So imagine this. You're Vice President-elect Mike Pence, and you know, you want to go out for the night. You're all been cooped up in Trump Tower, making important decisions all day, telling Trump what to do. And you're like, hey, I heard this Hamilton. It's about history or something. They sing. I don't know. I should go see that. And you go, and you bring your beautiful wife, and you're there. And they start rapping. You're probably a little surprised by that. You've never heard rapping before. You think about walking out as soon as they start rapping. But then you stay, and you kind of enjoy it. You decide it's actually about, you know, personal initiative, and it has a good conservative message. And maybe you're a little moved. And, you know, you convince yourself that everyone on stage is straight, and they're all, you know, they're all that you decide that there's no way that, you know, you're totally cool with it. You're really enjoying yourself. And then, man, you're ready to leave. And all of a sudden, this dude on stage is like, hey, we're terrified of you. That must be very upsetting. Right, Andy?
I'm sure it was, but he dealt with it well. Because he was walking out at the time. He was trying to beat the crowd. And well, he did stop and listen to it, right?
The report was, and I cannot confirm this, there was a report that the reason he was leaving early was because he was afraid they were going to make a speech about AIDS.
Okay.
And he did not want to hear that because he has some interesting views on that subject.
Yes.
So, you know, so he's leaving already for what might be not the greatest reason. And it's also, by the way, it is considered very rude if you're a guest of note to leave during curtain call. That's extremely rude. So he was already committing an act of rudeness. But so anyway, so he's sitting there, and Brandon Victor Dixon, who's currently playing Burr, I saw an earlier version of the show with the original cast, so I don't know about it. Yeah, you know, I'm fancy. So this is what he had to say to Mike Pence. And he was like, he's like, I see you leaving. Could you just wait a second? I want to say something. And then he said, we are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. Inalienable rights is actually really hard to say.
It is.
They should have thought about that before they wrote the comment.
Yeah.
But we truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us. I mean, that's not rude. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, that is, they're the guys in front of them. And, you know, to be clear, Lin-Manuel Miranda and other people, this was a planned, written out statement that the creator of the show decided should be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said in a tone of, we hope that this show has inspired you.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump, our president-elect, was extremely upset about this. and then joined the hipster backlash against Hamilton by saying it's overrated. He heard it's overrated, which means he's obviously following some of the same douches from my Twitter feed who have decided it's overrated and say it's rappity rap and say because it doesn't sound like Young Thug, it's no good. So I think that's his. I think mainly he wishes it was more like up to date hip hop, like kind of auto tuned Young Thug hip hop. That's his. I think that's his take, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, and then the other thing that happened, it's caused a rift, and this is really the national crisis that we have right now. It's caused a rift in the E Street Band, Andy. Rift in the E Street Band. What happened here?
Steve Van Zandt was shockingly horrified by this, said that it's very wrong to single out a certain person in the audience at a show and lecture them, that's no place to be doing that. Whereas, like, Nils Lofgren was...
The other guitarist in the E Street Band, yeah.
He was all on board. He thought it was a great idea, and it's crazy to be critical of
it. Then, I don't know if you saw this, but, like, the same week, Bruce Springsteen and Patti Sciarra went to see Hamilton, and Patti posts a picture of Bruce and her in front of the Hamilton, you know, billboard, and says, hashtag free speech or whatever, so she... And Bruce are taking the opposite side against Steve. So this truly is a national crisis.
It's a very rare split when the E Street Band is torn. It's torn the country in half. It's torn the E Street Band in half.
It's a schism in the E Street Band. I don't know how we go on from this.
Just stand back for a second and imagine if Pence saw the moment, walked on the stage, and gave a speech at the end and was like, I hear you. We are going to govern all Americans the same way.
He grabs the mic and he's like, I'm not going to throw away my shot. He kills it.
If he didn't do that, it would have been a great moment for his career and politics if he'd walked on and said something.
He's like, hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm old, angry, and Christian.
Or talked about gay conversion therapy and how important that is and how all gays in the country should get forcibly converted.
He steps on the stage and he's like, I can help you people.
Yeah.
All you need is electroshock therapy.
You need boot camp for a month, then you will no longer be gay.
It will be very unpleasant for a while, but then you can go to heaven.
Yes. Yes.
I don't think that would have gone over well, Andy.
No.
I don't think that would have
That would have been a bad message. But I do think Steve is not insane, to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
I do not like Pence. I think his views are detestable.
Okay.
I do think, I don't see what they accomplished, really. I doubt Pence listened to their speech and was like, you know what? I think I should be more supportive of all Americans of all kinds. I don't think it accomplished much. I think all it does is make the East Coast just seem more elitist, and I don't think one mind was changed, and I don't think that it did very much.
I mean, at the same time, they have the right to free speech. Well,
I'm not saying they didn't have the constitutional right to speak. I'm not saying they shouldn't have spoken. I'm just saying I question if it accomplished anything.
Well, they had Pence in front of them, and they got to let him know without a filter that people really are scared.
Right.
And that to me seems admirable.
Do you see Pence as someone that gives two shits or that?
Perhaps not. But the very funny thing, people have been mercilessly mocking some random person on Twitter who claimed to be there that they're like, I paid a lot of money to see Hamilton. Yeah. I didn't pay to hear a bunch of political statements.
Yeah.
which is
insane. But imagine the flip of it. Imagine if Obama saw some play and the cast was a bit right wing and they spoke at the end against him. Do you think the same people will be cheering that are cheering
I
now?
I think people will be like, all right. Like, I don't think anyone, certainly Obama wouldn't have gone on Twitter and be like, I need to demand an apology.
Well, obviously not. He's the opposite of Trump in every way. But I'm just saying, if you flip it, I don't know how well it works.
I would not be angry personally if someone had delivered a message to Obama on stage.
I wouldn't either. I just don't think it would be received in the same way this was.
So, do you think Steve at this point, Steve Van Zandt, do you think he regrets taking this stand?
Well, he doubled down, he tripled down, he quadrupled down when pressed about
it. This is interesting. This kind of takes me on a side point. But I interviewed Bruce Springsteen earlier this year, and we all read his autobiography, and one of the points was that, you know, Steve can be difficult to work with, was one of those points.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, because he has such strong opinions,
yeah,
and that sometimes he disagreed with him. And I think in Bruce Springsteen fans' heads, that means Steve is always right. He's like, more guitars, you know,
right,
like, you like, be cooler, be edgier. Like, and so he's like, I think in the fantasies of the Bruce fan, Steve is always the voice for good. But
yeah,
now you can see that, I mean, in my opinion, sometimes
yeah,
Steve is wildly wrong. You have to be like, Steve, I disagree with you.
Yeah.
And then he doubles and triples down, which is very interesting.
It is.
It makes. I hope he will come on the show soon and we can talk to them about
it. He can't be accused of being anything but very far left wing, though. I mean, his politics are in the right place for sure.
Well, you know, I guess so. Yeah, apparently. Yeah.
Steve Hedzant, come on. He's radical left.
Yeah. So, and what do we take away? Is Trump? Trump has now criticized Saturday Night Live. He said a musical is overrated.
Uh-huh.
Is he going to be like sort of the first art critic in chief? Like kind of.
Well, so then what pop culture does he like?
Well, he actually likes. You used to see him in Neil Young concerts. You talked to him about Neil Young once.
I tried to. I got him on the phone 10 years ago. I saw him at 3 straight shows by Neil Young in the front row, and then he got on the phone with me and couldn't name one song.
We should play that audio sometime.
I have it. It's hysterical.
All right. We got it. Okay, we're gonna do that. So we're gonna have feature a Donald Trump interview at some point.
That's been unheard by anybody.
Yes. This will happen at the moment we choose.
Yes.
We'll be like Trump at the moment. Everyone needs to be ready for the moment that we play your musical. But he couldn't name a song by Neil Young.
No, but what was so funny? I called his office. He called me back 3 minutes later. It was easier to get him on the phone than anybody in my life.
Well, this is why he won, Andy. Because he recognized the power of Andy Green.
Yes. It's all about me. Shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country.
I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. So this is a little awkward because we were going to be talking about Kanye West back when it seemed that he was just having kind of a wild week when he went on stage and simultaneously endorsed Trump and dissed Beyonce, thus doing the two worst things that he could possibly do all in the space of 10 minutes. And it seemed like mildly funny and kind of just Kanye-esque and like, you know, what's going on with Kanye. And then, unfortunately, it took a very dark
turn.
Well,
you gotta go back for a second.
Yeah.
At the most recent show, he went on 90 minutes late.
Right, yes, thank you, yeah.
Did two songs. No, he did 3 songs. He did one twice. Ranted for almost half an hour about Beyonce and MTV, then stormed off and didn't finish the show.
Yes, so, right. So, thank you. So, it took a darker turn. And then it took a really dark turn where it's kind of no longer a joking matter, which was that he was apparently someone, it wasn't Kim because she was out of town, but someone called the cops for a wellness check on Kanye. And he unfortunately was apparently taken to the hospital for, I guess, a psychiatric evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And man, this is dark, and it really bums me out, and I'm really concerned about Kanye.
Yeah,
and I think we're both, as are, you know, many people, genuinely huge fans of Kanye West. I know people who don't know his music have a lot of sort of ideas about him that he's just like some arrogant loudmouth, but the truth is he's absolutely a brilliant artist, one of the most important musical artists of the 21st century.
Yes.
And you know, it's always been this line he walked between like how much of this is calculated, how much of it is genuine instability, and now unfortunately, at least for the moment, it's crossed the line into, uh-oh, like, it's bad.
Yeah, it seems to be the first evidence it's real, because there's always been the question, is the voice in his head screaming about Beyonce all day long, or is this some public persona that he's created?
Yeah, and, well, this is what I'd be cautious. I'd be cautious on a lot of fronts.
Sure.
One front is to assume that just because he's having a pretty serious problem now, that he's always had a serious problem. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
in other words, you don't want to use this to discredit his work and to discredit his persona across the board. And I think there's a temptation to do that, and I think that's wrong.
I don't think that this retroactively will explain stuff he did 10 years ago.
Yeah, no. And I, you know, listen, there's precedent for this. I mean, there have been musical artists who've had problems.
Yeah,
you know?
You think of like Sly Stone or somebody where for where their brain works in a very unique way, and for a while that leads to groundbreaking music, but then eventually it starts working against them. And I think Kanye is hopefully not possibly at a place where it's not working against them, because the tour was just canceled. I mean, when you can't finish a concert, there's a major problem.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you said that's very true is sort of like the uncrossable line for a major artist, just on a business level, and also on a reputational level, is you can't not show up or not finish your concerts.
There are 20,000 people there. To go on an hour and a half late is, that's Axl Rose level crazy, but then to do two songs, rant for half an hour and storm off, that's beyond the pale. You cannot do that. And promoters are burned and will never want to work with them again.
Yeah, it's quite possible, as we discussed yesterday, that the promoters actually forced his hand to cancel the tour.
Yeah, there's a big question, who canceled this tour? Did Kanye say, I'm not doing these dates? Or did the promoters say, we will not put up with this?
To be clear, the excuse given was exhaustion. They said that he worked himself into exhaustion.
Right, but the press release was one sentence, and it was the tour's canceled, basically.
Yeah.
There was no explanation in the official press release. And if you think back to the Guns N' Roses tour of 2002, when Axl was showing up late and then missed a show...
He specifically, right, there was a show in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
And he reportedly, well, we won't get, he reportedly was doing something else.
Yeah.
Didn't get on the helicopter or whatever conveyance was supposed to take him to the show, and the show didn't happen. And there was a riot, right?
Yeah, there were riots, and he had been super late for previous shows. He's going on post-curfew, and the promoters said, we will not put up with this. We are liable if there's riots. This tour's over.
Yeah.
Because you have to cut your losses, because a concert that begins but doesn't finish, that you have to refund everybody, costs a fortune.
Right.
And so every night he's not playing, that's like $1 million that they owe.
Yeah, and to be very clear, for any artist, but especially an artist of the caliber of Kanye, the way you earn your serious money, your star money, is for the most part in these big concerts.
Right. And he's somebody who loses a lot of money on his outside endeavors, as he often talks about.
Yeah.
And so these long arena tours, they make back all his money. So this is going to cost him like $20 million in minimum if he doesn't make up these shows next year. And if promoters are not willing to work with him in the future, that's a major, major, major problem.
Yeah. And what makes me feel super bad for him is the sort of embarrassment of this. You know, his whole thing has been, I'm not quote-unquote crazy, I am a genius. And he's given us a lot of evidence that that is the case. You know what I mean? That listen, some of the things he says don't make a ton of linear sense, you know, some of his ideas. But then on the other hand, people were like, you're crazy to go into fashion. I know there's people who'd be offended by the word crazy. I'm not calling him crazy. But you know, people said, you know, that's nuts. You can't go into fashion. You're a rapper. No rapper has ever succeeded. You know, rappers can have their little clothing lines, but no one can go into high fashion as a rapper. It's ridiculous.
Right.
And, you know, people laughed at him about the leather jogging pants and all this stuff. He was right about all of it.
Yeah,
you know?
And this tour is incredible. I saw it at the Garden. I've seen 1,000 arena concerts. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
It was an amazing show, which is why it's so awful that it's over now. So he's a visionary. And
I didn't see this tour. I've seen him on other tours. Did you get a sense that he was in a different mental space?
No, he didn't say a word. It was over 2 hours.
See, that is a sign. That's a sign, I think.
Yeah.
In itself, the lack of spit talking.
Right. I think things changed following the Kim incident. I think
the robbery.
The robbery. I think maybe
you're absolutely right.
I think that had a major impact on him.
For anyone. This is why I think people have a problem. See, I have this weird thing because you know, like you, I talk to these famous people for a living often, and so I tend to have more of a sense of them as human beings, and I'm less likely to think everything's a setup, everything's a plan, because I know, like, I've been in the car with Taylor Swift when we almost had a car accident. Like, things actually happen to celebrities.
Right.
People have trouble believing this. They think everything's part of some PR plan. But anyway, so what people can't seem to empathize with is if your wife is held up at gunpoint, I don't care who you are,
yeah,
that is a traumatic and awful thing and destabilizing.
And if he's a bit paranoid and thinking people are after him and his family, and then the worst thing happens,
it's
besides
a hell
somebody
of a confirmation,
hurt,
yeah.
It's confirmation of all of his fears. And I think maybe... I think it was a major turning point on the tour. And after that incident, when the tour resumed, he started talking a lot. And the rants each night were increasingly were unhinged.
Yeah. I hope that he gets well soon. I hope that people are sympathetic and forgiving with him.
Well, but he didn't hurt anybody. Yeah. It's just canceled shows.
Well, the people are mad about the Trump stuff and the Beyonce. Yeah,
but he can come back from this very easily. It just takes one interview where he explains it.
Yeah, he says, "Listen." All he has to say is, "Listen, man. You know, I had a rough time. You know, this thing with my wife. I'm still upset about my mom. You know, and just move on."
Right. And they can rebook these shows next year. And if he finishes them, then it's a triumph.
Yeah, I think he'll be okay, but I am worried about him, and I do feel like he gets a bad rap to a certain extent, and the David Crosbys of the world are really mean to him. They don't understand him. But I think his fans will come back. I think he probably needs to explain that some of the things he says weren't him being himself. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice if for once he apologized to Beyonce, apologized to Jay-Z.
Well, to go from bashing George Bush to praising Trump, I mean, that's really a...
Well, he's idiosyncratic, but it seemed to me self-destructive. It seemed like he was trying to blow it up rather than his real beliefs. So anyway, this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. Please download our podcast at rollingstone.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you soon.